This edition of Politics and Science was recorded on WMRW on June 15th, 2009. It represents the viewpoints of its participants and does not represent those of any other organization. Coming up is Politics and Science with guest Arne Gunderson. Be back in a minute.
Arne?
Hi, it's Arne.
All right, and you are on the air, and you're listening to WMRW LP Warren. And it's time for Politics and Science. And, okay, I brought you up. Today on Politics and Science, we're talking to nuclear physicist and member of the Vermont Yankee Oversight Board, Arne Gunderson. Welcome back, Arne.
Oh, I'm glad you could have me back.
Yeah. And today we're going to sort of flesh out a little more of what we were talking about last time, which is specifically Vermont Yankee and whether Vermont Yankee is appropriate for Vermont to put in its energy portfolio, I guess, for Vermont.
Right.
And Arne, you mentioned last week that you were in the nuclear industry and for quite a while, and a vice president with a company that actually part of its job was to decommission plants. So I think you speak from a position of knowledge when it comes to what may be involved with Vermont Yankee if it is closed down. What were your experiences that led to your firing from your position with that company? And then I'd like to hear a little more about, you testified in front of Congress, and I'd like to know the role of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, how they supported you or not in that whole situation.
Sure. I hope I remember that whole list.
Yeah, but, I'll remind you.
Okay. I graduated in graduated college in '72, and I had spent a year as a reactor operator while I was in college, training students and other reactor operators. And then I went to work in the nuclear industry and changed jobs and became a senior vice president of a company that worked at nuclear reactors all over the country. And one of the things we did was we built the fuel racks for Vermont Yankee. So I'm intimately familiar with the inside of Vermont Yankee as my company installed the fuel racks that they had back in the 80s. I think after that they modified them yet again, but we specialized in high-density fuel racks, and my company, my division, actually built the fuel racks there. I did run a decommissioning group. We had a actually the company that now is doing Entergy's TLG. It stands for Tom LaGuardia. And when I was a vice president at the company I worked for, Tom was a director. And so we worked closely together, and a lot of his people worked with me when I was at that company, so it goes way back. Some of the things that we did at that company was we prepared estimates, just like the Vermont Yankee estimate, to determine how much money people needed to escrow. And then we also were responsible for the plan to dismantle the first power reactor ever decommissioned, and that was the Shippingport reactor. And my group came up with the idea to remove the vessel, the nuclear reactor vessel, as one piece. Before that, it had been thought that the best way to do it would be to chop it up with plasma torches and ship it off, but we determined that the radiation people received was too high, and the best way to do it would be to lift the reactor out in one piece. So we used it as a big trash can, and we put all sorts of other stuff inside it, put the lid on it, lifted it out, and shipped it down the river. We also did dismantling of other licensees that were not power reactors. There's 100 nuclear reactors in this country, around 100, and there's 20,000 licensees. So you can be licensed to have nuclear material and not be a nuclear reactor. Nuclear materials are used in jet turbines. They strengthen the steel with thorium, and they need a license for that. And we would clean up old sites that were contaminated with thorium and things like that. So I was intimately familiar with dismantling. I was on the company's radiation safety committee, and one day back in 1990, one of the secretaries came to me and she said, "Do you know there's nuclear radioactive material in the accounting safe?" And I said, "What?" So I went and I found out that, yeah, someone had stored four or five vials of radioactive material in the accounting safe. And I went for the radiation safety officer, but he had left the company 9 months earlier, and that was a violation. And I found the president and told him about all these violations, and he fired me.
He fired you for telling him?
Well, he said it was a reduction in force, but in fact, I was fired. And it's interesting because up until that point, I believed that the NRC was a responsible regulator, but I went to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission then as a whistleblower, and they agreed with the president of the company that I had been fired as a reduction in force. So then, you know, I knew something was wrong. So I went to John Glenn and Joe Lieberman, two senators, and I wrote to them, and they were quite courageous. They took the ball, and they got the inspector general involved, and the inspector general wrote two reports. One report said that all the violations I had found, and there were six of them, were in fact correct, and that the NRC botched the inspection. And the second one was even more damning, and it said that the NRC inspectors were taking illegal gratuities from my former employer. So, in any event, my former employer sent letters out to the entire nuclear industry accusing me of being a liar, and that kind of ruined my career. But from that point on, I view the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with some great skepticism. You know, I've been involved as an expert on a lot of things, and Three Mile Island, for example, I'm an expert on that, and the radiation releases the NRC said are bogus. They're probably low by somewhere between 10 and 20 times too low, and maybe even 100 times too low. And it would explain a lot of cancers that developed in the Middletown, Pennsylvania area after the accident. So basically I came away from my experience. This is way back in 1990. I came away from my experience with the NRC with a healthy disrespect for the NRC as a regulator. Now, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think you were. Can you hear me all right? I think you did.
Yeah.
So how did you become an expert on Three Mile Island, and why do you think the NRC came out with such low readings for the amount of radiation released there?
Well, when I left the industry, I was really good friends with a very powerful nuclear attorney. You know? This is back in 1990, and the guy was getting $700 an hour back then. So he was a high-powered attorney, and I had filed something called a 2.206 petition against my employer, trying to get some attention to the license violations that I knew were there. And he said to me, "Arnie, in this industry, you're either for us or against us, and you just crossed the line." And from that point on, I was locked out. I couldn't get work in the industry. And however, people outside the industry were aware of my experience, and I was contacted by the attorneys on Three Mile Island. And initially, I wasn't interested. I still believed that the party line, that it was a non-starter. And then they told me about the helicopter pilots who had died of cancer after the accident, and that got my attention. So I dug in, and I discovered that there was lots wrong with the official party line on the radiation releases from Three Mile Island, and there had been an explosion in the containment on the first day, a hydrogen explosion. Everybody was worried about it on the third day. In fact, it happened on the first day, and that the containment breached and that radiation was released that was unmonitored. So I tried to back calculate all this, and it's forensic engineering. You know, there's no evidence at that point. You've got to recreate an accident. In that case, it was about 15 years after it happened.
So, oh, wow.
In any event, I came up with analysis that showed that the radiation releases were somewhere around 15 to 20 times higher than what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission estimated.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot higher. So I've seen on a website on the computer that there's studies that do show a downwind higher incidence of cancer. I forget which direction it was, but you'd probably know.
Yeah, that's actually, if your listeners are interested, there's a great website. I gave a speech at the in Harrisburg at the state capitol on the anniversary of Three Mile Island just a couple months ago. It was the 30th anniversary, and I spoke in the capitol. And if you go to a website called TMIA, that's just four letters. It stands for Three Mile Island Alert. But the website is TMIA. And I gave the speech on March 26th. So if you go to TMIA March 26th, you can find a really good, I hate to brag, a really good speech on Three Mile Island. It's about 20 minutes long. And it's followed by another expert, Dr. Steve Wing, who works for University of North Carolina. And he's the guy who developed the maps that you're talking about that clearly show higher cancer incidences in the direction the winds were blowing on the first couple days of the accident. You know, it's not a lot of legwork to do the web search. It's just TMIA.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you got to commit half an hour to watch a couple videos. But they're good videos. And because it was in the state capitol, you'll hear music in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a marching band out in the rotunda. And you'll hear this for about the first 10 minutes of the presentation in the background. There's a marching band out there. So it's real science. It's not junk science. It's a lot of really good factually based analysis here.
So in your experience, so you got involved in Three Mile Island 15 years after the accident?
Yeah, the accident was in the late 70s, and the litigation was in the mid-90s. So yeah, 15 years had transpired before the, between them.
And
you have to remember, from 1979, I was on television in 1979 telling people that the accident was a non-starter. That there was no problem. You know, a little bit of radiation had gotten out, but everything was under control. And, you know, it was later in my career when I started really digging in and looking at it that I changed my professional opinion on it.
I see. So what actually did happen at Three Mile Island? You said there was an explosion?
Yeah, well, on the first day of the accident, in my opinion, the first day was the worst. Day of the accident, there was a series of almost routine problems that cascaded into a situation where the core could not be cooled, and a lot of these problems were mechanical, but a lot of them were operator issues where the people just lost control of what was happening. They had no idea what was happening. In any event, by about 7 o'clock in the morning, this happened at 4 o'clock in the morning, and by 7 o'clock in the morning, the core started to melt down. And it's clear. I've actually seen they brought in a remote vehicle, a little submarine, and put it in, and you can actually see the meltdown. The entire core melted to the bottom of the reactor. But anyway, at about 7 o'clock in the morning, almost every radiation monitor in the plant was off scale. It was pegged.
Wow.
And so from 7 o'clock in the morning on the first day until 4 or 5 or 6 days later, no one really knows how much radiation got out of that plant because every monitor was pegged. So everyone, including me, has to develop mathematical models. So at 7:30 in the morning, the plant, in theory, sent a helicopter over to the other side of the river to look for radiation. And they actually said this in sworn congressional testimony. And based on helicopter readings at 7:30 in the morning, they determined not to evacuate. Well, the only problem with that is that when you dig into the reports, the helicopter didn't get there till 8:30. So they lied to Congress.
Mm.
But they should have evacuated between 7 and 8 in the morning. There was another point at about 10 o'clock in the morning when they were reading 700 degrees of heat inside the reactor core. The reactor shouldn't get above 550, and that's an indication of hot gases, not steam, but hot gases. By about 10 o'clock, they knew that, so they should have known that hydrogen was being created. Hydrogen comes from the fact that the nuclear fuel is clad with something called zirconium. And when zirconium gets hot, it rips water apart, and it becomes zirc oxide, takes the oxygen out of water, and liberates hydrogen. So by 10 o'clock in the morning, they were making hydrogen, it's absolutely sure.
Hmm.
Well, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the building shook, and that was the explosion. There had been a spark in a containment. There had been a pressure spike in a containment. And then what I did and what the NRC didn't do is I went around and looked for data that looked for radiation monitors that weren't off scale, that went off scale after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And son of a gun, I found three of them. So almost everything was pegged, but three that weren't pegged became pegged within about an hour after 5 minutes after the explosion, which told me that the containment did in fact breach and radiation had been released.
Wow. So
all of that's on the TMI website, and it's a PowerPoint with me speaking over it, so it's pretty well documented. It's good science. You know, I had 100 different references in the paper I wrote, so
mm-hmm.
It's not junk science.
So it's not bragging, it's just fact.
Right.
As they used to say. So when you say they should have evacuated, you're speaking of the plant or the neighborhood around the plant, Harrisburg?
Well, the plant started evacuating. Portions of the plant became uninhabitable by 7 o'clock in the morning. They had evacuated the auxiliary building by 10 o'clock in the morning. I believe they should have evacuated out to at least Harrisburg. Man, you know, if I were plant manager, I would have done it at 7.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you missed a couple of those cues, you could make an argument that 10 o'clock would be okay. And in the worst case, if you believe that people were acting scientifically and not politically, when the building shook, the plant manager was in the control room when the building shook. And you know, when the building starts shaking, it's time to let the population know that it's time to evacuate. They didn't tell the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about that for 3 days.
Are you kidding?
No. The NRC did not know there was a hydrogen explosion on the first day until 3 days later.
What did they tell them?
They didn't tell them anything.
I mean,
another issue with Three Mile Island was that the temperature indicators were designed so that when they exceeded about 570 degrees, they started printing question marks. Or X's, I can't remember which. But they called the NRC. The NRC said, what's the core temperature? And they said, we don't know. Something's wrong with the detectors. They're printing question marks.
Huh.
Well, they did know. Those question marks meant they had a meltdown in progress.
Oh, jeez.
They didn't tell that to the NRC. You know, they gave them a half-truth.
Uh-huh.
That was all on the first day. And, again, it was about 2 days later when the NRC figured out that that a meltdown had definitely occurred.
Wow. And it... that point, so nobody except some plant workers were ever evacuated from. Nobody was evacuated from the neighborhood.
Well, actually, the plant manager, after the building shook and the explosion, the plant manager went up to Harrisburg and spoke to Governor Richard Thornburg and told him everything was under control.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in fact, they were all terrified and had no clue what was going on. But the presentation to the public was that, you know, everything's under control, no evacuations necessary.
Right.
2 days later, the NRC suggested that pregnant women should leave. And what in fact happened was that a lot of people, about 100,000 people voluntarily left the area over a period of, from the first day to about the fourth or fifth day, about 100,000, maybe 150,000 voluntarily left, but a lot stayed. There's good examples of, this happened at Chernobyl too, but and no one knows why. After an accident, people have gotten a metallic taste in their mouth. I've heard people refer to it as sweet and metallic or a metallic taste. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of survivors from TMI that will talk about they tasted a metallic taste, like confectioner's sugar and iron, a combination. And when they tasted that, they decided it's time to get their family out. So, but, the, you know, them. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence to show that a lot of people were, in fact, injured. Mm-hmm. You know, the industry says no one died at TMI. The industry paid out about $50 million in insurance claims,
huh,
victims of TMI. But part of the deal was that they could not, the victims couldn't go tell people their symptoms. So in the industry, you know, they basically said, well, we'll pay you, but we're not agreeing you did it, and you're not going to talk to anybody about what your symptoms are. So a lot of the deformities in young children and things like that were, in fact, compensated by the industry, but never acknowledged in any kind of a health database because of the confidentiality agreements in the lawsuits that went on.
And, of course, that means it would never make the news either because nobody could talk about it.
Well, on the 30th anniversary of TMI, NPR had a special. This was on a Saturday, on their Saturday program.
When was this?
This was March 28th of this year.
Okay.
And the NPR broadcaster said, this is almost a direct quote, "No one was hurt, not even a sprained ankle." And
wow.
Yet all of the scientific data that, you know, except the industry party line, indicates that hundreds, if not thousands, of people had cancer afterward. And, you know, there's stories of two-headed cows and on and on and on. There's an awful lot of evidence to indicate that there was an awful lot of radiation released. Helen Caldicott just wrote a book. Nuclear's Not the Answer is the name of the book. She's got a chapter in it about Three Mile Island. And she has never before published information saying that they picked up radioactive iodine 150 miles away in cow's milk. Now, cows in March are on silage, not from grass.
Yeah.
And that would mean that the cows inhaled the iodine. They didn't eat it off the grass because they're on silage. In any event, now that has ramifications on Vermont Yankee because emergency planning zones and emergency planning criteria have been reduced as a result of the way the industry analyzes Three Mile Island. The Vermont Yankee applied for something called the AST, alternate source term, and they applied right before they got the uprate, and it allowed them to reduce the amount of radiation that they claimed was released after an accident. They lowered the assumptions by about 40%, and they based it on the fact that no one died at Three Mile Island. Well, then right after they got that approval to reduce their assumed radiation releases, they then went in for the uprate, and that bumped it up by about 40%. Had they not done that, they couldn't have gotten the uprate because they were right at the dose limit so that they could, you know, you can only expose the population to so many rem after an accident. And had Vermont Yankee not gotten credit for that alternate source term, they couldn't have gotten the uprate. But the alternate source term was, in fact, based on erroneous assumptions about Three Mile Island. So we've learned the wrong lesson from Three Mile Island, and it rolls right into life here in Vermont right now.
Does that mean that if Three Mile Island hadn't happened, that they wouldn't have gotten the uprate because they wouldn't have had the basis for reducing their assumed leakage?
Correct. The entire industry has used Three Mile Island data on what radiation they think got out to lower the amounts of radiation that that they're allowed to assume after an accident. So, yeah, had not TMI happened, the upgrade could not have occurred.
So that was a very useful set of lies for the industry.
It was a useful change of assumptions for the industry, yeah.
Okay. When you have a leak like that, it sounds like that was not only radioactive waves, or was it waves and particulate that got out? Was it gamma, beta, and?
Yes, it was. It was. Yeah.
So it was
a lot of strontium 90.
Okay.
Which is a beta, a lot of cesium, a lot of cobalt. A lot of iodine. So most of it was particulate, which are predominantly alpha and beta emitters, although there was an awful lot of xenon and krypton, which are gamma emitters. So, yeah, everything got out.
And just for comparison, how similar are the two plants, Three Mile Island and Vermont Yankee?
Well, age-wise, they're about the same age. They're, you know, essentially the first-generation reactors built.
Okay.
But Three Mile Island was a Babcock and Wilcox pressurized water reactor, and Vermont Yankee is a General Electric boiling water reactor. So there's significant differences in how they're built.
And how does that those differences relate to safety issues? Like, is Vermont Yankee less likely to have an explosion like Three Mile Island?
Well, after the accident, Vermont Yankee and a lot of other plants did a lot of things to prevent an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
They put nitrogen in their containment to inert the containment, and they put little sparks inside the containment that are designed actually to get the hydrogen to burn before it explodes.
Mm.
But the biggest difference and the most significant thing that scares the heck out of me as a Vermonter is that the containment at Vermont Yankee is entirely different than the containment at TMI, and is weaker. The containment of Vermont Yankee is about an inch of steel, and that's it. The containment at it's just this inverted light bulb thing, which everybody talks about, that surrounds the nuclear reactor. And at TMI, there was three feet of concrete and a liner, a metal liner that was about a quarter inch thick. So there was a more robust containment.
Hmm.
Now, the NRC in 1972 determined that they never should have licensed Vermont Yankee's containment. And I think we talked about this in the last show, but there's documents from very senior people within the NRC saying they regret licensing this, what's called a pressure suppression containment. And had they not already licensed it, they would not have done it again. Later reactors, boiling water reactors, changed the containment, but there's about 20 of them that were in process way back at the beginning, and they're running. You know, and a deal is a deal. We made a 40-year deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean we need to make a 60-year deal.
I see. Now, when you have a leak, like you say, that the particulate, radioactive particulate escaped from Three Mile Island and people evacuated, which probably, if the particulate's in the air, that's a good idea to get away. But does it ever mitigate? Does it go away? Can you return?
Yeah, it's, well, at Chernobyl enough got out that you can't ever return. You know, they call it the dead zone. At TMI, it does mitigate for two reasons. One, the wind blows and it moves on and disperses. And the other thing is that it has a half-life. So over a period of days or weeks or months, most of it disappears. For instance, the iodine that was in the milk was bought by Hershey Chocolate, you know, the people that make Hershey bars.
Mm-hmm.
And what Hershey did, so as to not create a scare, they continue to make Hershey bars, and they're only 10 miles away from the plant. But they froze the milk. They freeze-dried all of the milk from all of the local dairies for 60 days.
Hmm.
And then they reconstituted the milk. The reason they waited 60 days is that all of the iodine would have decayed away in about 30 days. So to prevent radioactive candy bars from going out, they froze the milk, stored the freeze-dried milk, and then reconstituted and shipped it out 60 days later.
Hmm.
So they did the right thing for their stockholders. You know, they protected the image. There's not a lot of people that know about the Hershey's chocolate had contaminated milk.
No.
But they did the right thing, you know. But they never told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that cows, as far as they had the data,
mm-hmm.
so that cows as far as 150 miles away were contaminated. So, you know, my opinion is, as a corporation, they protected their stockholders, but as a citizen, they really owed it to the people within the state of Pennsylvania to own up and say, "Oh my God, you know, we've got iodine out 150 miles away."
And who discovered that? Who was taking the readings?
Well, that's a good question, and is still Hershey and the government were doing the readings, but it was unknown until Helen Caldicott just published her book.
I see.
So for 30 years, that information was suppressed.
Yeah, this really is a forensic study here, because, I mean, we all heard about it when it happened, but I think it went out of the view of the public, because the press dropped it pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's 30 years, so essentially half the country was born after the accident. So it's getting to be... you and I are getting to be more and more dinosaur-like as far as remembering the accident. You know?
Yeah, in other ways, too, I think.
I know.
We're talking to Arne Gunderson, who is a nuclear physicist and worked in the industry for a long time, and is more recently been a member of the Vermont Yankee Oversight Board, which I think you were appointed by Peter Shumlin, is that right, to look at the Vermont Yankee? And I was curious you said the board actually couldn't rule about the safety of Vermont Yankee. What aspects of Vermont Yankee did you look at?
Yeah, we were not allowed by statute to look at anything that had to do with Vermont Yankee's safety. And the reason for that is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission claims to be solely responsible for safety. And there's unfortunately, there's an awful lot of judicial decisions that would support that. So the state decided, well, we're not going to fight the federal government, and we're going to look at something other than safety. So they looked at reliability and what the panel thought there would be for reliability concerns on the unit. If the state votes on this, the stated position of a regulator cannot be it's unsafe. If that's the case, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will come in and say, we don't care that you just voted to shut it down. You know, you're preempted because you made your decision based on safety, and that's our sole domain.
Mm.
Now, if you, you know, the NRC has never not granted an uprate, and it's never not granted a life extension. So everybody who's gone in for a life extension has been safe and given 20 more years, and anyone who's ever went in for a power increase has gone in for 20 more years. So, you know, that's just something about the comprehensive inspections the NRC does, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So what we looked at was reliability, and we found a couple of major mechanical problems. We stated the condenser was a mess, and what happened last week is that Entergy acknowledged the condenser's a mess and it's leaking. And Entergy has known that the condenser's a mess since 2002 when they bought it. But Vermont Yankee's known the condenser's a mess since 1999. And yet we keep running it. So Entergy has also said that they're not going to fix it unless they're sure they're going to get a license renewal. Because it's a $100 million fix and there's not enough time to amortize the cost. So if they get a license renewal in 2010, they can't fix it for 4 or 5 or 6 years because it takes a lot of time to order the parts for a $100 million repair job.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be stuck with an unreliable condenser probably out to 2014 or 2015. The first 3 years of the extended life, we're going to be stuck with a condenser that's less than marginal. That was one item. Another was the isolation valves. Those are large valves that are meant to slam shut in the event of an accident. And we discovered that they were leaking a lot more now than they were before the upgrade. And now we can't say that's a safety problem, but we can tell the NRC it's a safety problem and they might look at it. Mm-hmm. But we can say that if they leak and if they have to be fixed, that's going to affect the length of outages and hence the reliability, which is what we did. So, but the more important things were the cultural issues that we found. The biggest one was that we found that management wasn't spending enough money and enough time on inspections that their employees went to them with and said, we need more time, we need more money to do these inspections. And it bit them twice. You may recall that in 2004 there was a transformer fire that shut them down for 16 days. And we determined that that was preventable, that there was enough information that their employees knew about that they could have prevented that fire if they had done things right. But instead, they were too anxious to get the plant running again. And the other one was the infamous cooling tower failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, of course, everybody has the vivid pictures in their minds, but Entergy has known, the industry has known that these towers, this particular type of tower, has a problem since the late 1970s. These towers are called the wounded knee design, and it's not a nice term. It was designed because they fall apart.
Yeah.
And so in the 70s, they knew they had problems. In the 80s, an Entergy subsidiary actually sued the manufacturer for crappy wood. Well, in the 90s, the Vermont Yankee towers began to collapse. Individual pillars rotted out, and they replaced them.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem was, and what they blamed the problem on was poor inspections. You know, they actually got to the point where wood was rotting out before they could find it. So they said poor inspections. That was 94. In 97, more wood rotted out, and they blamed the problem on poor inspections. Well, in 2007, when the tower collapsed, they blamed the problem on poor inspections. But, you know, if you've got poor inspections for 13 years and you don't do anything about it, the problem isn't poor inspections. The problem is management doesn't care.
Yeah.
And that was the position we took, that management could have avoided that problem. And, in fact, you know, now what Vermont Yankee has done to avoid this problem in the future is over a period of 3 years, replacing all of the wood with fiberglass reinforced plastic. Well, they knew about that for 15 years, but they didn't replace the wood with fiberglass reinforced plastic for 15 years because it was too expensive.
Hmm.
Had those towers not collapsed, the mentality within Entergy of, is it good enough to get me 18 months down the road when I refuel again? And there's only two more refueling outages before Vermont Yankee bumps up against the 2012 license termination. And so there's an awful lot of deferred maintenance. And the towers and the condenser are deferred maintenance. We also found the staff is getting real old. A large fraction were over 55. And a lot of them have been with the plant since the plant started up.
Hmm.
A lot of them have an institutional memory about how to do things, but as they retire, that institutional memory is evaporating, and they're not adequately training the new people coming in. We had one department had 86% of its people had been there less than 3 years. So you got all these new people with no good procedures on how to run the plant. Last year, Vermont Yankee had to evacuate the containment, and the problem was that they didn't adequately do a procedure correctly. And, you know, that's the problems that we identified. There's several more, but it really gets down to there's some component issues, but the component issues at their root are because, hey, this is a corporation, and they're out to make money, and they're going to squeeze this plant for all it's worth. And then on the soft side, on the management side, you run into the same thing, that they're not giving enough time and enough money to fix the plant right, and they're just trying to get it back running real quick.
Mm-hmm. And then we have the things, other things happening that... you sent me an article that they're trying to change the way they measure the radiation that's leaking.
That's another one that ties right back to the uprate.
Okay.
Before the uprate, Vermont Yankee emitted about 40% less radiation than it does now. So a 20% uprate creates more than 20% more radiation. And so what has happened is, and I testified in 2003, I testified to the Public Service Commission that Entergy was going to exceed the site boundary dose numbers. I mean, I couldn't be clearer. And I actually went into their analysis, and I found the errors in their analysis, and I said, the analysis is wrong, here's why. And so in any event, they got the license. And then presto, in 2004, 2005, 2006, and especially 2006 and 2007, the doses went up and they exceeded the site boundary number. Now, what Entergy did after that, they did three things. They put a massive shield in front of their turbine, just on the Vermont side, not on the New Hampshire side. So they basically said, we're not worried about the extra dose in New Hampshire, but we are worried about Vermont.
And this is a shield for x-rays, or?
Yes, this is an x-ray shield, yeah. Right. So they did that. They changed the fudge factor that they calculated dose with. They found a consultant who gave them a different fudge factor, and it gave them lower doses. It's called a dose conversion factor. And basically, it's only 60%. If you put a radiation detector at the fence boundary and you came up with a number, let's say 30. Well, Vermont Yankee, 30 is over the limit, by the way. Well, Vermont Yankee applies a 0.6 multiplier to that and comes out with 18, which is under the limit.
Hmm.
So this dose conversion factor is a fudge factor to get them below the limit.
And
so they've done those two things, and Department of Health went right along with the dose conversion factor. And now they're buying extra property. So the 20 millirem is the limit for Vermont at the fence post. So what they've done now is they're realizing, whoa, this is going to be really hard to run. We better move the fence post out. So they're buying property all the way out to the road so they can get the fence post out further.
Mm-hmm.
They can get the exposure down at the fence post. It's not emitting any less radiation. It's just that the law says it's 20 millirem at the fence post, so they're buying land and moving the fence post.
So they're basically changing the goalpost, as Peter Shumlin said.
Yes, I love that comment.
Yeah.
So when you can't make a goal, you make the goalpost wider.
Sure. And he's thinking, Peter Shumlin, who's pro tem of the Senate, I believe, he's going to appoint you to a position. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, basically, since all the recommendations were made, and there's hundreds of recommendations, some of them by the contractor in January, and some of them by our panel in March, there really hasn't been any public oversight of whether Entergy is effectively implementing these recommendations. So what Senator Shumlin has done is he's asked me to spend 3 days a month meeting with the department and meeting with Entergy and reading material to see if they are effectively meeting the criteria.
Hmm. And it sounds like they're not too happy about that.
That's an understatement.
That's an understatement. Well, you do sound qualified to be the judge of that. When you're talking about, you looked at, as part of the oversight committee for the state, you were looking at reliability issues because you couldn't touch safety. But you were also maybe looking at cost. Was that one of the factors you could judge whether the cost was a good deal for Vermont, the cost of the power?
Well, that's being addressed in the hearings in front of the Public Service Board, and that's a great line of question. If we had 2 hours, we could talk about it.
Okay.
What happened is that the department, to their credit, especially an attorney named John Cotter for the Department of Public Service, really reamed Entergy on that issue. Cost. The cost has gone up. In 2012, Entergy is not going to give us a reduced electric rate. That's absolutely clear. Everybody knows that. Now, they're not bragging about that, but in fact, they're giving us not giving us the rate that we have now. So your bills are going up regardless of whether or not we get that power from Vermont Yankee or whether or not we get that power from another source. The bills are going up in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually asked the Entergy keeps saying, you're going to save $1 billion with us over 10 years. And they said, will you guarantee that number? And they said, no.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, well, what's a good number? And they said, we don't know. So, you know, we're stuck believing that we're going to save money if Vermont Yankee keeps running, but yet no one can quantify how much we're saving. And then you've got that little thing called decommissioning, which is, you know, out there too, which if you save $1 billion, but it costs you $1 billion to dismantle the plant, what have you saved?
Yeah. And we did talk about that some last time, and it doesn't, in my mind, it doesn't sound like a very good deal for Vermont at all. And when you're looking at the cost, can you factor in, you know, potential problems like, evacuations or things that would decommissioning, for instance? Can you factor that into the cost? Because I don't believe when Governor Douglas is saying it's cheap energy that he's factoring in the fact that we may pick up the tab for decommissioning it.
Yeah, we cannot factor in anything that's safety related. So if Brattleboro gets wiped off the face of the earth tomorrow and it costs $1 trillion to evacuate the area and clean it up and things like that, we can't factor that $1 trillion into any analysis because that's a safety issue.
Wow.
But, you know, Vermont legislature is our brand managers. It's like Coca-Cola or Tylenol or whatever. You've got a brand, and you want that brand to have a good image. And Vermont has an image. You know, it has an image of purity.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is pure milk, and part of that is, you know, Ben and Jerry's ice cream and Cabot cheese and maple syrup and skiing and foliage. And as brand managers, we can say, well, what if this plant is unreliable and just for one day releases enough radiation that you got to shut down Route 91. What's that going to do to the state's reputation for purity? That's something that a legislator can assess in their head. And frankly, there's not enough money in the world to pay for a ruined reputation for purity.
Right.
You know, you're only a virgin once, and that's not going to be an effective marketing ploy ever again as far as the state goes.
That's true. So the Public Service Board is also looking at Entergy's application to become basically form a shell company that will then own Vermont Yankee. What's your opinion on why they're doing that?
First off, the panel is crystal clear that if they do that, it will not be in Vermont Yankee's best reliability interest. They're only going to have, if they spin off their five plants and do this, one, Entergy will make $4 billion. The spinoff will be stuck with $4 billion in debt and will be undercapitalized and will be actually junk bond rated. So there won't be enough money if Entergy needs, if Envy needs a repair, if Vermont Yankee needs a repair. There's not enough money in the till to keep all five of these plants well maintained. So the panel's position is it's a terrible thing for the state of Vermont. The market is judged as junk bond.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they're attempting it is Entergy will make a hell of a lot of money on the order of, like I said, $4 or $5 billion. and they'll swing off a merchant nuclear facility, which with obligations to its stockholders to pay them a dividend every year, which will put increasing pressure on these plants, one, not to make repairs, and two, to keep them running a lot so they can pay the stockholders. It's not a good deal for Vermont. It's a great deal for Entergy.
And it's just on the face of it, it appears to me that they're trying to get out of being liable for decommissioning it. Does that factor into it, or is that just a false assumption?
What it does is Vermont Yankee is already a limited liability corporation, and it's already owned by another limited liability corporation. But if they spin off this Annexus, they'll put two or three more limited liability corporations in this corporate chain.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it is they're afraid to show the liability on their books. You won't find this decommissioning liability on their books because they're playing numbers games and saying, we don't have any liability. If we wait 60 years, we'll be able to pay for it. So there's a game being played with how this is reported on their 10-Ks and on their yearly report to stockholders. This decommissioning liability is not being effectively covered.
Now, somebody told me that the situation around New Orleans is similar, that Entergy owned a plant down there that they spun off into a shell company, and they basically abandoned it after Katrina. Is that true?
Sort of. You're almost exactly right. Entergy had the distribution company in New Orleans. They didn't own the plant.
Uh-huh.
They owned all the wires. And when Katrina came in, the wires collapsed. They didn't have enough money to fix it, and they declared bankruptcy.
Hmm.
And they just said, you know, screw you, we're not going to fix it. So they got enormous, you know, federal bailouts and all that stuff. And as a present to their president, who was able to get $300 million in federal bailouts, they gave him $29 million that year in bonuses.
Wow.
So 10% of the federal bailout that went to helping the people of the state get electricity went instead to the president of Entergy's pocket.
And you're saying Entergy didn't have to fix the infrastructure, all those wire distributions?
They did. After they came out of bankruptcy, they fixed the infrastructure, and now they're back running.
Yeah.
But if you talk to a lot of people in New Orleans, they're really pissed at Entergy for playing that game. It was hardball. They basically went to the politicians and said, we're going to shut down the city forever unless you bail us out.
All right. Well, we have a few minutes left, only about two or three, and we should probably talk about that you're going to be over here in the Mad River Valley at the Big Picture Theater, and I don't have the date. I can get it. Do you know the date, Arnie?
I have it here, yeah.
Good.
It's at the Big Picture Theater on Wednesday, June 24th, and it's from 6 to 8 o'clock. And actually, it's not just me. There's a great group of panelists. Lawrence Mott, he's into wind power. James Moore from VPIRG, Dr. Nancy Chickering from Physicians with Social Responsibility, and Adam Greshen, he's your rep.
He's our local rep, yeah.
And I will all be there. It's only about 40 minutes of presentation and an hour and a half of questions. So it's a good chance if people want to come to get to ask some questions.
Yeah, that'll be great. And
it's free, by the way.
And it's free, and it's at the Big Picture Theater in Waitsfield, and it's June 24th from 6 to 8 p.m., and the number to call is 496-4566 for more information. Well, Arnie, thank you so much for being on again today. I feel like we still more to talk about, so maybe we'll get you on for a little preview, if you're willing, before the panel discussion over here.
That's great. Or, you know, we can wait and see what else breaks.
Okay. That sounds good to me. Again, Arnie Gunderson, thanks so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. And that was a very fast Politics and Science with your host here, John Barkhausen. And the preceding show did present the viewpoints of its participants and did not necessarily represent an official viewpoint of WMRW or its license holder, Rootswork. And again, Arnie Gunderson will be here with the rest of the panel on June 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Big Picture Theater in Waitsfield, 496-4566. to find out more about Vermont Yankee, and it's a discussion of our energy future. And Adam Greshen, our representative, will be there. And I'm sure everybody on the panel will be more than happy to answer your questions. So I think that wraps it up for me today. And coming up in just a few minutes, or just a minute, is Democracy Now!, followed by Free Speech Radio News.
Blues and Beyond comes on at 7:30, and that's followed by Green Mountain Global Local with Dan Eckstein. This show was pre-recorded on June 15th, 2009. For more information about politics and science, you can email info@wmrw.org.